My name is Cassidy McCabe, and this week I'm speaking with Tonya and Michael Galbin from the Skonandagan State Historic Site.
We are the site of a 17th century Seneca village, and it's our responsibility to share that history as we've learned it from our elders and other academic Native elders and other academics, to search out firsthand accounts, of which Michael has a large library here at the Seneca Art and Cultural Center. And so Skonandagan, from 1655 to 1687, that was the last occupancy of a principal town of about 4,500-ish Seneca people, Onondaga people. And they inhabited about 150 bark longhouses here on site on the top of this hill. And they lived here for quite a while, and they were, before that, rotating, you know, the village, rotating village life. And until the relationship with the French had gone sour because of King Louis in France had declared that beaver fur, of all things, would be the fashion of France, and of which here in this country there was plenty of beaver for a while. And the Seneca people, the Haudenosaunee in general, the Seneca, were supplying that to France. Basically, the Seneca people had to go further and further away from this village here, Skonandagan, to procure those beaver pelts, those beavers. And this took time. And as we know it, you know, in our business world, time is money. And mm-hmm. It was the same for King Louis. And so they wanted to wipe out the middleman, being the Seneca. And this caused strife. This caused a war. And so it sent King Louis to send his man, the Marquis de Denonville, to Seneca country to annihilate the Seneca, take out that middleman. Well, they were not successful. Basically, they were not successful, and that's the basic story of Skonandagan.
Thank you for that. Are you able to share with us the story of the Seneca mothers of the Haudenosaunee?
So your question related to the Seneca mothers is, you phrase it in a way like there's an organization or something, or are you just, because you capitalized it in your email, I'm just, for clarity's sake, are you speaking of just Seneca mothers in general, or are you referring to Seneca clan mothers?
I think the clan mothers, yeah.
Okay. So for the Seneca people today, there are 8 clans, which can be interpreted as families. And each of these families or clans is either a bird or an animal is the designated emblem, right? So you have, in the Seneca tradition, 4 bird clans, more or less, and 4 animal clans, more or less. That's the how they see it today. It's divided into 2 groups, and they're mostly birds and mostly animals. So the bird side of the system includes the heron clan, hawk, snipe, and deer. And the other side of the system, which is primarily animals, is beaver, bear, wolf, and turtle. And so each one of these clans has a woman who is responsible for the membership in her family or in her clan. Then these women are known as the clan mothers. And they, you know, bear a lot of responsibility in their community in terms of working with any issues related to families or individuals, They are in charge of naming children, for example, and making sure that the clan lineage of the new children is preserved. This is particularly important because the leadership of the traditional Seneca communities comes from and is descended through the clan lineage. So male leaders, who in English are people most often say are chiefs, these are official titles which must be filled with the proper individuals to have a healthy and functioning nation. And so the clan mothers are in charge of maintaining the lineage, but also selecting from their brothers or sons their leadership, the chiefs, or we'll call chieftainship titles. The way that the clan system is perpetuated is that children inherit the clan of their mother, and also the fact that Seneca people are exogamous, which means they marry outside of their family, and so that means that two people who, you know, form a couple or married couple have to be from different clans. Only the mother's clan is left in the children. The father's clan is not passed along. I mean, that's one of the major functions, really, to maintain a healthy community is to organize and make sure that the lineage is all maintained and known in order that leadership can be placed in the right places, you know.
It's also their right to adopt. From alien nations. Also, it's their right to forbid their sons to go enter into war. They also control the public treasury, which would be the foods, and they could provide a levy on foods for festivals, ceremonies, general assemblies, or for charity.
Would you be able to share with us some of the intersections of the Klan with the women's suffrage movement?
What we've learned, primarily through the work of Sally Roche Wagner, who really has done the most research on this topic, we've learned that the early American suffrage leadership, you know, was in close contact with Native women, in particular Haudenosaunee or Iroquois women. Well, we can just say a few instances of that intersection. At one point during a national conference, Susan B. Anthony introduced to the public a Mohawk physician named, you might even say stage name, was Princess Viroquois. She was a Mohawk lady, last name of Martin, who she introduced so that people could understand really the Native perspective in this national conference. There was a speech about Native women and their views on American women's suffrage and how it was really, in a lot of ways, an outdated concept to them. You know, they had always they'd always enjoyed certain responsibilities and rights and never had to seek equity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, one of the famous leaders, like Matilda Joslyn Gage, she was even spending time when living in a Seneca community trying to understand what the clan mother's council, you know, where they, how they interacted with the men's chief's council and how did that all work out. She spent so much time there and was so interested in the system that the women there actually adopted her. Some women adopted her from the Wolf Clan in the 1890s and gave her a Mohawk name, actually. So, I mean, the intersections and the writings of these women that reflect, you know, the impact that they felt in learning about Haudenosaunee women, I mean, it's part of the historic record. I'll read you a short paragraph that Matilda Joslyn Gage wrote in the 1870s. She writes, the division of power between the sexes in this Indian Republic, in referring to the Haudenosaunee people, was nearly equal. Its women exercised controlling power in peace and war. No sale of land was valid without consent of the women. The family relation among the Iroquois demonstrated women's superiority in power. In the home, the wife was absolute. If the Iroquois husband and wife separated, the wife took with her all the property she had brought. The children also accompanied the mother, whose right to them was recognized as supreme. Never was justice more perfect, never civilization higher. And so, you know, hearing a little bit of what these women had to say, you know, once they understood Haudenosaunee culture, I mean, I think that, at least for them, was a powerful influence.
Yeah. Thank you so much. From what you've seen of the history of women's suffrage in modern movements, do you feel there are elements of the movements that embody the legacy of the Haudenosaunee?
Still continuing.
Yeah, I don't think so, in my opinion.
Okay.
I don't think so, because the organization of the Haudenosaunee people reserves responsibility based on gender. Mm-hmm. So you have a system which, you know, you might say the leadership is selected by women in particular, and women at the time reserved they had the right to initiate a war or to stop a war. I think that the way that Haudenosaunee people realized would be a benefit to them is a little bit harder, I think, for contemporary people to understand, because there is a gender specificity, you know,
mm-hmm.
And yet I think it's something else to explore, I would say, to make a point of including women in decision making in a modern context, I feel like would be a great step forward. But it would take such a revolution politically that I don't know how it would pan out, you know?
Yeah.
I'll share this. It's my favorite thing to share. The closest I come to the United States government and our women, our clan mothers, coming together. And that was when Hillary Rodham Clinton was on her First Lady campaign of Save America's Treasures tour. And she sat with our clan mothers here at Ganondagan. And one of many that she asked that really stuck out was, well, how do you come to make decisions for all your people? And the clan mothers, they told her, one of them spoke for them, and I believe it was Geraldine Green. She said, we ask ourselves three questions, and they are, you know, will this decision that I'm going to make promote peace? And if she can answer that in a positive way, she'll move on to the second question, which is, will this decision that I'm going to make will it promote peace, or will it harm the environment 7 generations into the future? And if she can answer that in a positive way, at least Geraldine Green related that they'll go ahead with their decisions.
Mm-hmm. So that's all the questions I have. Thank you so much.